critical race theory is banned from Florida schools. Controversy over lighting up the Acosta Bridge during Pride Month. And a local bakery stirs up some controversy of its own. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross. And this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Watch us, too. The stream is live now on Facebook and YouTube. Then later, it's a new vision for the Jacks Riverfront. We'll tell you about it. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, we welcome Kelly Wiley of WJXT, Channel 4, the local station. Hey, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics back with us. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on again.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jacks Daily Record. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Melissa.
And rounding out our foursome, Catherine Lewin, new to the Florida Times Union. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning.
So good to have all of you on the show. Lots to talk about this week. Again, we are also streaming live video on Facebook and YouTube. Watch us there. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Join our Friday roundtable right now. The number is 549-2937. Man, it was a busy week in the news, but we're going to begin with our top story. There were protests in downtown Jacksonville yesterday as the Florida State Board of Education met here on the FSCJ campus, and they approved a controversial rule banning teachers from teaching what's known as critical race theory. They even tacked on a last-minute addition to the rule banning what they call theories that distort historical events. Not only critical race theory, but also the New York Times 1619 Project and Holocaust denialism added into the mix. We're going to begin the hour with a closer look at what the state did yesterday that will affect public school students. What are your questions about this? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. There's been a concerted effort, Kelly Wiley, on behalf of Republican legislators around the country to put critical race theory into the spotlight. This is a theory that's been around for decades in academic circles. It's just an academic model that encourages students to see the history of America through the lens of race and understand that there are structural underpinnings of racism in our society that affect everything from public policy to taxation to the criminal justice system. Governor Ron DeSantis, however, says that he believes teaching CRT will teach kids to hate themselves and each other. At the Board of Ed meeting, there was quite a bit of impassioned comment. In fact, Ben Frazier of the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville even had to be escorted out by security. And so as we talk about this, I think it's important to observe that this isn't happening in a vacuum. There's been a strategic effort to push this to the forefront of the news and the public's consciousness, not just in Florida, but across the country. Kelly Wiley, your thoughts. Oh, she's muted. Let's go to AG. AG.
Well, regarding a question, as I heard it, basically it was what's happening on the right to make this critical race theory thing prominent.
Right.
And this is the thing. It's kind of one of these issues where it's a solution looking for a problem that doesn't exist. Nobody's teaching critical race theory in the classroom. It's not critical race theory class.
Yeah.
You don't go to kindergarten and get that. This is something that is very easily messaged by people like Ron DeSantis. And he talked about it for months and months. He messaged about it three times before the board passed it. And then he does a fundraising appeal talking about cultural Marxism. We know what our public schools are like. They are not hotbeds of cultural Marxism. You can barely get discussions of equity in there. And when you look at these discussions of how to frame history, how to frame dogma, this is something that happens in late-stage democracy. And what we are seeing here right now is pretty much a grim crossroads between one side and the other. And DeSantis is basically saying, we're going to define history this way, it's going to be this way. You can't really have much inquiry beyond this in the K-12 system. You know, critical thinking, that's somebody else's problem. And this is the kind of stuff that happens in, you know, places like Hungary. This is the kind of stuff that happens in places where the democratic ideals that we talked about in the 20th century no longer exist in the same way.
5492937 to join us. Here's a tweet from a listener. Critical race theory acknowledges the reality that white people committed genocide against indigenous peoples and enslaved Africans to use as labor to help build the nation. To ban it is to pretend our country just spontaneously appeared without anyone suffering for it. On the other hand, you know, I think AG's absolutely right, Kelly, if we have you on now. This certainly is a cynical political maneuver by the governor and others around the country to push this to the forefront rather than focusing on pocketbook issues that affect us all. What about the narrative that has come forth from supporters of the governor that teaching these concepts about systemic racism encourages a culture of victimhood? That's something that we've heard a lot in recent weeks. Kelly Wiley, are you unmuted there?
I'm on now.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think what we've seen is a lot of school districts, one, to AG's point, they're not really teaching this currently. So we heard Dr. Green say yesterday that this doesn't really change anything for their curriculum, the decision that was made, that they already feel that they were not teaching what would be described as critical race theory. So that's one thing. And then I think there's also a confusion about what the definition of critical race theory is. We've seen some people say that critical race theory is teaching people to believe that they're racist or this is a racist country. And then we've heard other definitions of critical race theory that talk more about things like Axe Handle Saturday, events that have happened in America's history that have dealt with race and that have dealt with racism. So that's also something that we're seeing people having completely different definitions of critical race theory mm-hmm. as they decide what they want to see taught in schools.
By the way, this is just my own aside, but this whole academic theory, like a lot of theories put forth by academia and those on the left, has a branding problem. I don't think they could have come up with a worse name to terrify conservatives than the three words critical race theory. Just my two cents there. Mike Mendenhall, you know, in thinking about this, this month, we observed the 100th anniversary of the massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where a thriving black neighborhood known as Black Wall Street was burned to the ground. In Florida, at about the same time, a community called Rosewood was burned to the ground, and thriving African Americans were massacred. And for the most part, you are not taught about these things in school. When I was a kid, the only reason I learned about slavery was because my parents made my brother and me sit down every night and watch a miniseries in the 70s called Roots. It was the TV version of the best-selling book by Alex Haley. I learned more from watching that miniseries about America than I ever learned in school. And so I think that that is what is unfortunate about all of this, is that most Americans really don't know the full history of this country, and they have to learn it through the popular culture or through seeking out knowledge on their own as adults. They don't really get the full picture in public schools, and now they certainly won't.
Yeah, Melissa. So, you know, one of the important things, you know, to keep in mind, too, when we're talking about this, is you have to in our school system, you have to put these historical events into context for every student, because if there isn't an understanding of why these massacres occurred and the context around it, you know, the distrust between people, the latent animosity, it's just going to continue. And, you know, and it's kind of an old fact that, you know, history repeats itself. If you don't understand it and you don't acknowledge it, you know, it repeats itself. And so we have to educate our young kids, you know, and you know, so they understand why these things occurred and how to, you know, and how to continually, you know, strive to be better as a country and a society and a culture. And, you know, if we continue to have a very, black and white, you know, version of history taught in our schools, we'll never reach that point.
Yeah. And Catherine Lewin of the Times Union, it was interesting to note, too, that the State Board of Ed also banned any discussion of the New York Times 1619 project. Hannah Nicole Jones, the journalist that wrote that whole piece, which won the Pulitzer Prize, was recently denied tenure at a university in North Carolina because her work has been controversial. Certainly the first slaves did come to America in 1619. That's not in dispute. But I think the reason this has become so controversial is she moved the Overton window of the narrative of America. With her work on the 1619 project, she recast the narrative of America. America didn't begin in 1776. It began over 100 years earlier, she's saying, when the first slaves arrived on these shores. And the United States was built on the backs of slaves. The wealth that was generated came from the evils of slavery. That is at the heart, the beating heart of what opponents of teaching critical race theory don't want to acknowledge, unfortunately. Five, four, nine, 2937. As we try to get Catherine back on the air, I ask you all to bear with us. We're still in pandemic mode. Hopefully we'll have everybody back in the studio soon. 549-2937. Andy in Mayport. Hi, Andy. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. Yeah. Yesterday on the program, I think Mr. Frazier made a great point when he was saying we should teach the truth. And like you said, with roots, you know, that's important stuff, you know, our children should know. I think there's a big conflation of critical race scholarship, this post-structuralism, post-modernism, post-colonial, this Hegelian dialectic, with actual teaching of Black history or having more of a racial consciousness. So I would encourage people to check out the primary sources. And frankly, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, from what I can see, it would be concerning for my daughters to be learning that type of stuff in school. I think it's a little too extreme.
Thank you, Andy in Mayport. Kelly Wiley, you know, the thing about this that's curious is that teaching kids critical thinking skills is something most people acknowledge is important in our 21st century world. And yet there's this backlash against that we're now seeing. technical issues. Sorry, guys. Let's try A.G. Gankarski, Florida Politics. A.G.
Yeah, I mean, that's the paradox. I mean, the higher level inquiry that moves advanced cultures onward is something that theoretically you'd expect us to want. But in practice, I mean, we see that schooling very often is a means of control, of regimentation, of segmentation. And, you know, we see what's happening in the basic skills competitions. We're losing the more and more countries on the higher level things that actually make a society work. You see it reflected in shortages of skilled labor in Northeast Florida. Labor leaders talk about it. And that's the kind of thing. But the paradox is that to vote in these right-of-center people, you have to give red meat to the base. And you give red meat to the base by giving them grievance politics. It is much easier to talk about what is in some corporate history book than to talk about the devaluation of the currency and how your labor is worth less than your father's labor and your kids' labor, God help them. They're not going to own anything. That's the real question facing people in Florida. But instead, we're talking about these corporate textbooks and what can or can't be put in by formula. It is a joke. It is something that plays really well with Republican primary voters, and Ron DeSantis has basically $40 million in the bank for reelection. So As much as we say about it, it is resonating with somebody.
Catherine emails the show, I never learned anything about race in school. It wasn't until I entered college and had a great history teacher who put things into context that I became more educated. We need to teach as much as we can. Lots of tweets about critical race theory. Kevin tweets the show, we need to ask why we didn't learn about events like Tulsa, but we all learned about Nat Turner and John Brown. Roger tweets the show, teach American history warts and all. If we forget our history, we will be doomed to repeat it. We are seeing a repeat of Jim Crow voter suppression, and we can do better. Kelly Wiley, if you're back unmuted now, what are your thoughts about the governor saying that critical race theory will teach kids to hate themselves and each other? Basically, what he's saying is that if white children learn about the history of racism, they will be made to hate, and that African American children or children of color will also hold hate in their hearts. It's a curious statement, given that these events all happened a long time ago. They're not involving people who are walking around on the planet today.
Yeah, I think that's at the heart of this debate. I think there is a group of people that believe what the governor is saying there. And I think there's another opposing group that believes teaching this will only teach us to understand our history better and teach us to better understand each other and treat each other better. So there's kind of a dueling ideology of what teaching about these events and putting them in context will do to students and how it will shape how they feel about each other. But this is an issue that we've seen schools are already dealing with, whether or not they're teaching it with this context or not. We saw all throughout the school year several Black at Instagram pages pop up from private schools, from public schools in our area, where kids were voicing how they felt they were being treated at school by their peers, about systematic that they were noticing. We saw Douglas Anderson School of Arts deal with this, and it was quite an issue for them how to handle that conversation. We saw Bull School also was trying to move forward with the diversity, equity, and inclusion curriculum, and parents voiced issues with that to the point that it was changed. So this is an ongoing issue they're dealing with how to address feelings that kids of color, feelings that children who are white are already having, and conversations they're already having. So the question seems to be, how do you facilitate that?
Ian in Springfield. Hi, Ian. You're on the air.
Hey, Melissa. I just wanted to ask, you know, why do you think maybe some people want to get rid, they don't want to get rid of all the Confederate monuments and names and statues and stuff, but yet they wouldn't want to acknowledge slavery that built this country with things like the 1619 Project? Thank you.
Yeah, I think that gets to the basic question, Ian. And here's an email from Matthew. He writes, it seems problematic when anything identified as a theory is actually banned from education, which has the fiduciary duty to engage and encourage thought, analysis, debate, diverse perspectives. Please mention, Florida didn't have any sanctuary cities, but they were banned anyway. Our election went well, but the state's voting laws were altered. Racial justice protests happened last year, but that were largely peaceful, but we still passed an anti-riot bill. There's no teaching of critical race theory in Florida schools, but it got banned anyway. In essence, the governor is solving problems that don't exist and campaigning on it. Catherine Lewin, that gets to AG's point that we do have to look at all of these moves through the prism of the governor's ambitions, which I think are widely acknowledged by this point, to run for president in 2024. Catherine, are you there? Unmute yourself,
yes.
Catherine. Go
Can
ahead.
Can you say that last part again? You were lagging a little bit.
Okay. I think we need to look at not only the critical race theory move by the state board, but everything that's been happening in Florida through the prism of the governor's political ambitions.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's certainly become pretty obvious, especially from what I've covered. I covered a bill signing that Governor DeSantis did last week. They had some slogans like Make America Florida, is kind of like a play off of Make America Great Again. I'm sure all of this plays into a strategy.
Yeah. And it's 549-2937. Lots of people on hold, but guess what? There was another huge story this week that also is part and parcel of the culture wars in this country. So we're going to move on now and talk about Bridgegate. Yes, the Acosta Bridge is once again awash in rainbow lights, but they were turned off earlier in the week, sparking national outrage during Pride Month. This whole flap actually ricocheted around the state because we also learned that a couple of other bridges were denied permits to light up in rainbow colors. After a lot of back and forth, the bridge lights are back on in downtown Jacksonville, Mike Mendenhall. But certainly it has upset the LGBTQ community. They and others plan a march this weekend across the bridge.
Yeah, and this bridge lighting issue is happening just as we're starting to see other moves by the DeSantis administration to play into the whole idea of culture wars. I mean, you've got he recently signed the bill banning transgender athletes from participating in public school sporting events, and it's also kind of happening at the same time in the national narrative, where I think I read that the U.S. Senate just decided to, or sent a bill to President Biden's desk to make the Pulse nightclub a national monument. So, you know, it's really localizing the conversation about where we are as far as LGBTQ rights are in this country, and how we treat and accept that group. A recent poll showed that we're to a point now where 70% of Americans are actually in favor of same-sex marriage. So really the conversation is changing, and any attempt, whether it's intentional or not, on the Florida Department of Transportation's part, it was the optics of it were very, very bad. And I believe FDOT came out and said that they had, in an email, had received several complaints about the rainbow lights on the bridge. However, they did not necessarily document the names and of the folks who actually were complaining.
Certainly, the governor's possible opponent, Nikki Fried, capitalized on this, AG Gankarski. She actually came to Jacksonville and shot a video in front of the bridge with young Democrats trying to cast the governor as homophobic. There have been other incidents involving the governor, the transgender female athlete ban, cutting funding for programs that serve this community in the wake of the Pulse massacre. The governor's office saying, though, that they had nothing to do with this, that this was done only at the FDOT level. And so, again, whether it's critical race theory or this issue, this governor's race is going to turn on these culture war issues.
You know, I always tell people this. Any statewide politician, Governor Scott, Governor DeSantis, whomever, they see Jacksonville as their homecoming game, an easy market full of easy marks that they can bring any sort of messaging out and tell them whatever and get away with it. They underestimate the media, they underestimate the people, and they do their touchdown dance on our faces. And we've seen it this month. When they came to Jacksonville and signed a bill banning trans athletes from female athletic competition in the state of Florida, you know, is one of these, you know, solutions, you know, for a problem that didn't exist yet again. They did that here in Jacksonville, and they counted on uncritical coverage. When they got critical coverage, they shut down the question and answer. Fast forward a week and a half, you know, to the Pride Light situation. And, you know, the fact is that they did this plausible deniability thing. Oh, we don't know who made the complaints. 5 phone calls. We don't have caller ID. It's 2021. How stupid do you think we are? Pretty stupid, it turns out. And the critical race theory vote, obviously DeSantis was on his fundraising trip out west, so he did his video in from a hotel. He sounded like he'd been up all night. And, you know, meanwhile, Richard Corcoran's there taking the heat. There was some poetic justice in that. But that's three times in the month of June that the DeSantis administration has clowned the people of Jacksonville. And, you know, my question is, what's next?
Kelly Wiley, I think you're the one who first broke the story that the FDOT only did get a few calls complaining about the rainbow lights. There isn't any record of that. AG makes a great point in that Jacksonville has long been a conservative redoubt, a conservative stronghold in Florida. However, the demographics here are changing, and there is a robust local and regional press to cover these issues substantively. So that added a lot of context to what's been happening here in town this month.
Yeah, I think everyone, all the journalists here locally have really been trying to work together to figure out exactly what happened. From what we can tell, JTA, we all know that the bridge, Acosta Bridge, has become this really cool feature of our city. They've done lights for Christmas. They do lights for Black History Month. They did lights for when Trevor Lawrence was coming.
Yeah.
This has been something that they've been playing around with for quite some time. We know that they make kind of a calendar of different light features that they do based off of requests they get and just based off common observances that come around. For them, they say that this was the case with Pride. This is a common observance. And they'd also gotten some social media requests to put it up. They put it up, and FDOT says they got 5 phone call complaints to their Jacksonville urban office. And from there, they took it to district management, and district management made the call to JTA. They say that it was the phone complaints and the fact that it, you know, this didn't fall within their permit that was the issue. The background of that is neither was the Trevor Lawrence tribute, neither was the Black History tribute, the Autism Awareness tribute. Most of the things that they've done do not fall within the permit. And so then we get to what Senator Robert Gibson said, which is this selective enforcement. And that's the big question. We know with other areas, St. Pete, for instance, the mayor's office asked them to make their Skyway Bridge into a rainbow as a tribute, and they were denied. Now, in that case, FDOT, which this is a different district office, they say they denied several organizations in that case. They denied, you know, the Tampa Bay Rays. They denied the Heart Association. They said it was more an issue of that particular bridge can't do as many colors. But
there was a third bridge in there was another bridge denied the rainbow lighting too, though, wasn't there?
In Sarasota. Yeah. And so we've seen a lot of advocates talk about this. In particular, we talked to Equality Florida, one of their officials there, who says this to them is really the cherry on top of a lot that's been going on during Pride Week, which has already been mentioned. The bill dealing with trans athletes, the Pulse Survivor Mental Health Funds, they feel like Florida Equality has said in particular that this is an attack on the LGBTQ community.
Catherine Lewin, Times Union, it all amounts to an unforced error, honestly, for the administration, because there has been now a national flap over all of this, and a group of people is going to walk across the Acosta with pride on the 5th anniversary of the Pulse nightclub massacre. This Saturday, they will also be demonstrating against Florida's recently signed anti-trans bill. Your thoughts?
I did see that there was going to be some protests there this weekend. And, you know, I think especially from, some of the interviews I did talking to people in the LGBTQ plus community and advocates, you know, people were really, really upset about this, understandably, for all the reasons that Kelly already went over. There was a story about it in the Washington Post. Like, I just think it got a lot more traction than maybe people in the state government or maybe even in Jacksonville thought that it would. And, you know, I talked to a couple people who I think felt disappointed because they felt like, you know, Jacksonville is turning a corner. Things are changing here. It's not the super, maybe conservative area that it once was. And I think this was disappointing for people.
Right. Mike Mendenhall certainly was seen that way by some. At the same time, though, I think it's important to note that bipartisan majorities of Americans support equality for LGBT people. They support marriage equality by 70% plus. This is now the transgender community is still working very hard toward better understanding and acceptance. But by and large, the culture has moved on from this. So that's what made it all the more curious, honestly.
Yeah, which plays into what AG's earlier point that, you know, a lot of this, a lot of these kind of issues are really just, you know, our right-wing politicians trying to play to their base as well, and really kind of hold on to that, or try to hold on as long as they can to those more, to those older American viewpoints and what are called, you know, traditional American values is what, you know, that's definitely the buzzword on the right for that. I mean, eventually, you know, as public opinion shifts, I mean, those ideas are, you know, those older, more antiquated ideas are going to fade away through, you know, through elections at some point. You know, either, you know, the politicians that are and the leaders that are still holding on to those views are going to have to shift, because, you know, at some point the voters' viewpoints tend to win out.
John on the South Side. Hi, John. Happy Friday. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning, Ms. Melinda.
Melissa, go ahead.
Are we talking? Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Okay. On the LGBT question, I am not a Democrat or a Republican. I'm basically a centrist. Now, as far as having a right to marriage, and everything, that's between the states and the governments. That's one thing. But now when we start talking about scholastic athletes, even though an trans person may say, hey, I feel like a woman or I feel like a man, okay, and we agree, okay, you can make that decision for yourself. But when you start competing and scholastic sports against others, say in this scenario, you got girls over here that are girls, and then you got a transgender young man who says he's a girl, but his physiology is still a boy. So guess what? When they race, he's gonna beat them. Period. The same vice versa. If it goes to vice versa, those boys will beat that girl. And that is just not right, because what happens? Then all the regular girls, they start losing their trophies. They can't, you know, their scholastic is bad. So that was my thing on that. And remember, all of this, what we are seeing, this is...
Hey, John, and I think you're getting to what the governor argued when he signed that ban. And I appreciate your thoughts. Thanks for calling. But I do want to point out that over the last decade plus, only 11 children total who identify as transgender have even tried to compete in any sport in the state of Florida. 11. Not just 11 this year, 11 in the last decade. So we're talking about a minority of a minority of a minority. We're talking about a tiny group of kids who are already so marginalized and so terrified to be themselves in school. So I would just ask you to have some compassion for that. But I do appreciate your thoughts. Now, speaking of the culture wars, a Jacksonville Beach bakery waded into all of this mix this week after they posted some anti-LGBT messages on social media. This, of course, happened at the Jacksonville Beach Institution of Sinatis. And they apologized for what they posted on social. At the same time, they experienced what the businesses tend to experience when they make a political statement. A lot of people said they would never shop there or buy there again. Other people lined up to buy their products. We've seen this at other bakeries around the country this Pride Month, particularly one in Texas, A.G. Gankarski. The people in Texas put out a rainbow cookie and experienced the same kind of thing, but on the other side.
Yeah, the culture war, you can't beat it from marketing.
Yeah.
It's hard to say what was going through the poster's mind when she shared a meme that was probably shared with her and so on and so on. But it was obviously not a decision that should have been made by somebody with a business identity. It's one of these things where I honestly think people, you know, when you look at decisions like this that a business like Sinatis makes, you might want to boycott forever, but there's somebody on the other side that's going to double up. And that's kind of the issue with these things. They kind of wash out, I mean, in terms of the boycott's efficacy. Again, though, it's like this story blew up to become one of the major stories of the week. And in the end, it's just somebody who owns a bakery making a really dumb decision. And, it's ironically not a pocketbook issue in many ways, but it's been blown up to one where, you know, with all the things going on right now, we're talking about.
Exactly. You know, Catherine Lewin, Times Union, we have been through a year plus of pandemic. People are dying and sick. They're out of work. They're desperate for jobs or desperate just to pay their bills. You know, we are dealing with just incredibly serious issues. And it is remarkable that everything is fixating on this. Critics might say by design that these are all coming to the forefront to distract from the state's failure to meet the needs of the people.
That could very well be true. That's certainly been true in other states and at the federal level. Hard to say for sure. I think some of these arguments, and I guess what we could call culture wars, have also just been going on for a really long time, even before this.
Curtis on the north side. Hi, Curtis. You're on the air. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, Melissa. Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. Very quickly, here we are in the cusp of the city talking about, and the governor talking about, bringing all kind of companies, big companies, great jobs, great pay to our area. And here we are. We can't even have a recognition of a pride celebration in our city. What does that say to the country and to the world about Jacksonville? But yes, we want all this new development. And one last thing, I think people should get out of their comfort zone, push their biases aside, and actually go and reach across racial and sexual lines and get to know people. If you come to my house to a cookout, Melissa, and I'm going to invite you one day, you're going to think you're at the UN. You're going to see couples who are, you're going to see male married couples. You're going to see lesbians. You're going to see straight people. You're going to see all kinds of people and all walks of life.
But how's the barbecue, Curtis? How's the barbecue?
It's great.
I bet it is.
I'm going to invite you, Melissa.
I'll come.
And that's all I'm saying. We need to get out of our comfort zone and stop being afraid of the things we don't know and understand. Get to know it. Reach out. You may be surprised what you may learn and find out and how you will grow from reaching across those lines. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Curtis. Thank you so much. And I appreciate the invite, too. I'm sure it'll be great. Kelly Wiley, Channel 4, you know, what more can you say other than he's absolutely right. So much of this stuff is driven by fear and ignorance and not understanding people who are different from you.
Well, first, I want an invite too.
Yeah, let's all go.
I think the reason why people really grab hold of these things because when you look at it on its own, it's one business that's, to AG's point, said something that they have said they regret. But I think people grab onto it because, one, it's during Pride Month, and a lot of what I've heard from people who are in the LGBTQ community is that it just kind of feels like a big blow during a time when they want to celebrate who they are. We did do an interview with Mike Sinati, who runs that bakery, and he told us, you know, he said, what you see on social media is not a true picture of who we are. And he said he would invite anybody to come have a cup of coffee and sit down and find out who they feel they really are. Mm-hmm. We've also heard from the LGBTQ community, Stephen Gaskell, who's the president of the Florida LGBTQ Democratic Caucus, say the post was tone deaf and at worst, incredibly homophobic. And he said, especially now in Pride Month, where they're celebrating the LGBTQ community. So I think it's the timing. I think it's the climate. Tensions are high.
Yeah, absolutely right. A tweet from Deborah, please point out the assumption that Jacksonville is a conservative bastion was belied by the presidential results in Duval in 2020. The tide is turning, she says. Okay, with about 5 minutes left to go, we want to make note of some other news and notes from the week. Yes, folks, it's our lightning round. That's just for you guys. Okay, I'm going to start. Let's talk about a historic year for the Women's College World Series. For the first time in nearly four decades, two teams that lost their first games in Oklahoma City advanced out of the loser's bracket to the championship finals. It all comes down to FSU and Oklahoma. Good luck to Florida. Oh, I'm sorry. They lost. Guys, you know I don't follow sports, Josh Torres. Thank you, Josh. All right, that was my mistake. It's also National Rose Day, so we wanted to mention that. AG Gankarski, bring us up to date on what's going on with the city's mayor's races and races for sheriff. You've been covering both of those.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I've been covering while y'all have been talking about cooking. Mayor's race. Daniel Davis, chamber chair, or CEO rather, he has a political committee. He's well over $2 million cash on hand. Matt Carlucci and Al Ferraro are the two Republican councilmen who are filed. They can't raise money. Ferraro was under $10,000 for a second straight month. Carlucci, he netted about $6,000 to his campaign account. Family members are giving him money, but both of them are in trouble. Mm-hmm. Sheriff's race, look for Democrat Lakeisha Burton. Y'all talked about her program. She would be the first black woman to be sheriff. She would be a Democrat. Bipartisan support. And one more thing, where were the politicians when the lights were being changed on the bridge? There was not a single local politician who came out and protested against the Pride lights being changed.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Mike Mendenhall, what's going on in your world?
Well, Melissa, I'm still keeping a pretty close eye on what Shad Khan and the Jaguars are going to be doing down on the riverfront with their proposal to redevelop the shipyard. What they're doing right now with the Downtown Investment Authority is going, or what they could be doing possibly, is going to have a real big impact on possible riverfront parks in our downtown area and really kind of define development down there for years to come. So I think that's going to be a story to watch here over the next couple of months.
Sure is. Catherine Lewin, new to the Florida Times Union, by the way, and welcome to town. What else is on your radar this week? Oh, my goodness. We've lost her again. Okay, let's go to Kelly Wiley, Channel 4, the local station. Tell us what you are following this week.
Well, what I was following before we got to Bridgegate, as you call it.
Yes, Bridgegate.
Was what's going on with evictions and what's going on with rental assistance that the city and United Way of Northeast Florida has been working on. So far, they're really having a hard time reaching these people and getting the applications processed Right now, they've given $1 million of their $23 million they have for this to close to 300 families. But we found there are more than 2,600 families still waiting to get their rental assistance, some of which are facing impending evictions.
That brings it all home, doesn't it? All of these other stories are important to cover, but really, nothing's more important than the fact that people are really struggling out there, which we will continue to talk about on this show. And so I want to thank all four of you for being with us. We really appreciate you being not only on the radio, but also on video. Again, you can stream us every Friday on Facebook and YouTube. Thank you, Kelly Wiley of WJXT Channel 4, A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics, Mike Mendenhall with the Jax Daily Record, and Catherine Lewin of the Florida Times Union. Guys, thanks and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
Thanks, all. A quick break, and when we talk about developing the riverfront, Shad Khan has a vision, but so does another guy, Stephen Adkins of Southeast Development Group. What's he cooking up, and what would he do to make the North Bank more exciting? A closer look at his vision for the Jax Riverfront in just a moment. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
On the next Science Friday, Biden's Assistant Secretary for Health talks about the disparities that have been exacerbated by the pandemic and about the healthcare rights of trans youth.
I think these youth need to be supported, advocated for. We need to work with them, helping them achieve the treatment and care that they deserve.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
It was a decade in the making, but the Keystone Pipeline is officially dead.
Big Oil had never lost a fight like this.
Also this week, infrastructure talks crumble, fears over inflation rise, and Senator Joe Manchin finds himself out of favor with many in his own party for not being for the people. We'll get to all of it on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's billed as a bold new vision for the Jacksonville Riverfront, a planned new development along the North Bank that creators say would be an exciting front door for downtown. For more, I spoke with Stephen Adkins. He's principal at the Southeast Development Group. Hey, Steve, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So tell us more about your vision for the North Bank and the introduction of this new plan. It's called Riverfront Jacksonville. Tell us what you'd like to do with the property.
Well, Melissa, this is a master plan of about 25 total acres along the North Bank of Jacksonville that runs from about the easterly side of the Times Union Performing Arts Center all the way down to the Berkman Plaza. And our plan envisions reimagining that space and redeveloping that in a very comprehensive way that takes a approach that would allow for a lot of public accessible space as well as new private development. So sort of a marriage between both the public and private interest. Mm-hmm. Within that 25 acres. We envision about 15 acres of public park and plaza space that will run contiguously along the riverfront itself. And, you know, that would also include a number of public investments in a new river walk, a new marina, the park itself, and the infrastructure that supports those things. It's, as again, as I said, it's a master plan, and we envision mm-hmm. that to be the new face of downtown Jacksonville.
Right. You call it the front door for downtown. Something else that you've built into this master plan is resiliency in a way that is more innovative than some of the plans we've seen put forth in the past. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Resiliency, as you are aware, is super important in any new waterfront development in most areas, but in particular here in North Florida, we recognize that it's going to be something that we're going to have to address in a meaningful way. If many of your listeners were here in 2017 and remember the Irma storm, the hurricane that we had then, we had significant flooding in the downtown area as well as a number of other areas of Jacksonville. But there was approximately between $85 and $100 million worth of damage caused just from that storm alone. And then the downturn in business and the paralyzation that our downtown faced for weeks and weeks thereafter really was a significant economic impact. So we have to address that in a meaningful way. What we've done in our approach is to create what we call parking trays water barriers within our design that would allow us to make the parking spaces for all this 25 acres subterranean so that none of the buildings have to be built on top of a parking podium. But it also allows for that to act as a resiliency buffer for not just this development, but the frontage of the downtown central business district. And what would happen in the event of a storm surge that can't be addressed from just green space along the waterfront, those parking structures can be evacuated and they can fill with the storm surge water as much as possible and mitigate the damage and impact that we have from that. The way that that would work is that the water would enter into the vaults of the parking structure first, and then if it overran the vaults, then the parking structures themselves become receptacles for the storm surge, and then when the storm subsides, they're able to pump the water back out into the river.
I like that. I like hearing about that. And I'm curious to ask you where you take this now to the powers that be. We need to make clear to folks this is a separate plan from what Shad Khan and the Jaguars are proposing for a parcel that's a little east of where you would be operating with Riverfront Jacksonville. So what are the next steps for this vision in terms of getting city leadership, the Downtown Investment Authority, and others to buy into your proposal?
That's exactly right. It's a collaborative process here forward. We have submitted what we call a vision plan to the Downtown Investment Authority about a week ago, and they have just received the information. We anticipate that over the next few months that we will sit down with them and work through details of what we're proposing. We also are very interested in hearing more from the public and what they want in the space. We've done a lot of that research already, and we've met with groups that have interest in seeing what happens downtown, the Riverfront Parks folks, as well as others. We believe that this needs to be a collaborative effort. We really want to bring the downtown North Bank Riverfront to its highest and best use, and one that creates a plan that's really collaborative in the sense of that the public gets a say, what they really think needs to happen, the city gets a say. We talk about what those investments look like over the long term, not just up front, but over the long term, and one that can really build equity throughout our community so that really it's a win-win for everybody.
I'd encourage everyone to check it out online. Their website is jacksriverfront.com. And he's Stephen Atkins, principal at Southeast Development Group. More about this on our website, too. Stephen, thanks so much. We'll follow along.
Thanks, Melissa. I appreciate it.
Again, that's jacksriverfront.com. And go to wjct.org and just click on news. to learn more about all of the various development plans that are now in the works for downtown along the Jacksonville Riverfront. Things could look very different in a few years in the urban core. We'll keep following it. That's our show. Thanks for listening this Friday, and thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Make sure to join us, by the way, today at noon on the Florida Roundup. It's our live statewide call-in show from the peninsula to the panhandle. We cover the biggest stories each week across the Sunshine State. The Florida Roundup, today at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. This show will be back at 9 a.m. Monday, and everybody have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.